I'd like to call to order the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. It's 8:05, Tuesday, March 29th. Present are Representatives Sadler, Gardner, Foster, Osterman, Dick, and myself, Chair Munoz. We have two bills up today for committee hearing, HB 196, Bulk Fuel Loans and Power Project Fund, presented by Adam Berg with Representative Bryce Edgman's office, followed by HB 178, Election Procedures. So we will start, Adam, if you'd like to come forward. We have two additional fiscal notes on the bill. They're before you. You should have copies of the fiscal notes. Did everybody get the fiscal note? Yes?
They're all.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Adam, do you want to start with a review of the fiscal notes? And then we have off-net Mike Harper from the Alaska Energy Authority, as well as Winnetto Ayers from DCCED is here as well. So, Adam, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Adam Berg, staff to Representative Bryce Edgman. We do have two new fiscal notes, one from Economic Development, one from DCRA. And if you guys have specific questions on the fiscal notes, both Scott and Lonetta are here to answer them. But the main goal of this is to pay for the program with the interest spun off this bulk fuel revolving loan account. So, but if you want to specifically ask about the numbers, I'll defer to Lonetta and Scott. The only other thing that had come up, I believe, during the last meeting was on page 3 of the bill, lines 14 through 16, we've suggested deleting the language, who has written endorsement from the governing body of each community for which a loan from the fund is sought. I've circled back and talked to the offices that brought up those concerns. I'm under the impression that they're okay with the bill as it's reading now, but I defer to both Rep. Gardner and Rep. Dick on that.
So. Okay, Representative Dick, did you want to?
Yes, we did have the conversation, and deleting that portion really does help everybody to keep life simple.
Okay, great. And you did
and
contact a lot of the communities.
That, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and deleting that portion just makes life simple, and there's plus and minus both ways, but that would be definitely as simple as and best for the folks around.
Okay. Thank you for following up with your communities. Are there additional questions, Representative Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also had concern about deleting the requirement that the local government endorse. I don't have a lot of experience in small rural communities, and I'm going to take my lead from those who do, but it still troubles me. And as a state agency providing a lot of funding, it seems to me appropriate to have local government involvement and to encourage people to participate in their government and solve the problems that they're having in their own local government if they can't function well enough to proceed on something like this. But I don't want to adversely impact the intent of the bill, which is simply to make it possible for people to get fuel efficiently and inexpensively as possible. So I'm not going to stick to the point, but it does trouble me.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Just to say, I try to picture this in my mind, and it was really hard because I could picture some communities are right on top of it, and they definitely need to have be more aware of what's happening. At the same time, there's other communities where folks might be at fish camp or here or there, and it's just asking everybody to always consult with the local government. Just some places doesn't work at all, and it would be actually to their benefit if to be out of that loop. So I think there's enough interaction right now. It's kind of the lesser of two evils. But it'd be better right now to just to delete that passage. But I wrestle with that. I spend hours and hours and hours trying to envision different communities and how it would work in one and not in another.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dick. Representative Osterman, did you have questions on the fiscal note? I know that last meeting you did. Okay. Thank you, Adam. Scott, would you like to come forward, please? Scott Ruby with DCCED, Director of Community and Regional Affairs. Thank you, Scott, for joining us today. Could you go over the fiscal notes, please?
Sure. The two additional fiscal notes that were added, one was from DCRA, one was from Division of Economic Development. the DCRA fiscal note. Currently, the biggest change in that is right now the bulk fuel loan bridge loan program is funded by a general fund appropriation of $219,000. That money goes to paying the contractor, paying for travel for the contractor and staff to provide technical assistance to communities. And we have an RSA with Division of Economic Development for $45,000 to pay for their accounting and administration of the program right now. Part of that came when 2 years ago when the bridge loan was statutized. Before it was our contractor, Rural Alaska Fuel Services, was managing the entire thing, including the money was in a bank account with their name on it because it was grant funds. When we had to bring that inside the state system and change the statutes, we didn't have, there was no fiscal note and there was no change in the to reflect that different form of administrative costs. So we continued to pay the contractor at the rate that we were, and we made up for that by paying DED what their costs were for that. The fiscal note that is reflected here is DCRA's portion of it. If we look at 2013, because 2012 is going to be a transition year and it gets a little it's harder to interpret, but in 2013 we're expecting the program to cost $252,800 to administer on DCRA's part. Those monies, as Adam said, would come from interest earned on the fund. Those monies would be spent to pay for currently a DCRA person that would administer the contract and approve the loans, do the due diligence on the loans before they're approved, and run the program, administer the program. Again, $40,000 would be for travel for the contractor or potentially DCRA staff when they have to provide technical assistance that the contractor is not able to. And then we have $120,000 for contractual costs. I know, and then DED's fiscal note basically is that there's a $80,000 to pay for administration of that, and that is one position. I believe it's a accounting tech, or that's figured by the cost of an accounting tech to set up the loan programs, account for them, do the invoicing, do the collections, do all the reporting associated with that. I know in the previous meeting the concern was that the new cost of running the program is $333,000.2, and currently the cost is $272.6. And I think the and so we're making the program more efficient, and it's going to cost more to run. I think part of the issue there is that right now all the costs aren't reflected in what it's being running the program. For instance, there is no funding for a DCRA position to administer that in the current funding load. And so we are paying part of that position that's administering the contract and the 11 positions out of our general fund, and it's not reflected in that $219,000 cost. I think the other issue is, in the way fiscal notes are, is it may not be a full-time position in DCRA to administer the program, the new program. It may only be three-quarters of a position, but the way fiscal notes are, you need to add a full position and the cost for that, and we don't have the funding or the ability or the prioritization to take that on the administration of the extra 60 loans with our existing staff.
Are there questions for Mr. Ruby?
Thank you,
Representative Gardner.
Thank you for the explanation. It still seems to me, if we're going for efficiencies and having one shop stop instead of two, that it should save us money and not cost us more. You know, it just seems like something's padded. But I'll leave that for finance.
Okay. Representative Dick?
We've had the conversation, but I'd just like to clarify. You spoke about this being more efficient, and we're here in this building, we're always talking about accountability. Would you just speak to how maybe we could make this whole, that the added expense would help us to fulfill that responsibility to be more accountable?
Well, I think you know, a lot of the efficiencies that we see is the ability, the efficiencies as perceived by the communities. They're only having to do one application than two. It speeds up the process of getting the loan approval. We're not in jeopardy of having loans held up by short barge deliveries. On the accountability side, by bringing currently the 60 members under the AEA program don't receive any technical assistance that is funded by the bridge loan program. And under the new bill as it is, if they do have some, they do require some assistance, it may be setting rates, it may be helping them be more efficient or better or more reliably, they would have access to this technical assistance as a routine basis. So I think it'll streamline that, because currently if there were a problem, they'd have to relay that to AEA, and then AEA would contact us regarding that. You know, if they're paying their loan on time, you know, they, even though they have some issues with cash flow management, but they're making their loan payments on time, that technical assistance may not be brought, or that technical assistance need may not be brought to the Alaska Energy Authority to the surface.
Thank you, Scott. And I'd like the record to show that Representative Cisna is with us online. Good morning, Sharon. Maybe she's no longer online. Okay. She is there. Okay. Representative Osterman.
Thank you. In looking at the fiscal note from AEA of 53.4 or 53.6 that they've been taking out of the bulk fuel loan fund to run this program, and then I look at these two fiscal notes together at 333, I'm having a hard time, and I still don't understand what you're talking about. Did AEA take, what have we got, $252,000 coming out of, did AEA take $252,000 every year out of the bulk revolving fuel fund to run their program?
No, AEA took,
according to the fiscal note, it says
53,600 out of.
You want to take $252,000 out of it now because we're getting the money.
Yes, and some of that, it's supplanting $219,000 in general fund money that's now coming up. So,
wait. Supplant $219,000 in general fund that's doing what?
That currently DCRA gets a $219,000 general fund appropriation every year to administer the bulk fuel bridge loan program.
The bridge loan, okay.
Under this fiscal note, that money would no longer be required. Because it would be a fund source change, and so that money would now be coming out of the proceeds from the loan program.
So with this change, your department now is suggesting that they roll the 219 in general fund that's been going to the bridge loan program. As you've been receiving a yearly allotment of
yes,
219.
Correct. And I think in the fiscal note, we tried to reflect that through the chair, Representative Osterman, in 2013. If you look under the funding source code, where it shows a negative 219 and an increase from the fuel loan of that. So.
Yes, please.
So, okay, so I take the 219 out, and I'm still at 114,000 compared to 53,000. So it's double, for move it over there, it's double to operate out of DEC as it is to operate it out of AEA.
It's
the efficiency of moving it over there.
It's approximately 60,000 more.
I still. Thank you, Madam.
Yeah. Well, what is the wish of the committee? Do you want to see additional work on the fiscal notes, or are you ready to take action on the bill?
I'm ready to move the bill. I just question. inefficiency of an operation if we got double the cost because we're trying to be more efficient. So.
All right. Also online is Mike Harper with the Alaska Energy Authority. Are there questions for Mr. Harper? No. Okay. Can we have a motion on the bill to bring the bill before us, please, and then action on the bill? The bill is before us, but what is the wish of the committee at this point? Yes.
Move Option 196 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is ordered. Thank you very much for the presentation today. And can we have a brief at ease, please, while we get the report together? Thank you. To order, and next up on the agenda is HB 178. And before you today, we have a CS for HB 178 version X. If I could have a motion to bring this to our attention, please.
It's a version? Or?
Version X. Does everybody have version X?
I don't.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can we get another?
Yeah.
Does everybody have the bill?
I don't have version X.
Okay. Terry, we need a...
Yes. I've got.
Now I do. Thank you.
Okay. Does everybody have it? Yes. Can I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Madam Chair, I move we accept the CS for House Bill 178, version 27-LSO304/X.
Great, thank you. And Cecile Elliott is here with Representative Thomas's office. Thank you. Cecile, could you walk us through the changes in the CS, please?
Sure. I'm Cecile Elliott, staff to Representative Thomas. I'd like to thank the committee for hearing the bill today, and he will not be with us as he's at the LBNA meeting. Based on previous discussions, what was removed from the bill was the ability to vote by email based on conversations and the concern about security, and also if the other provisions of the bill moves forward as it is with the 45-day requirement and the ability to deliver information and ballots electronically. We feel that addresses the concern about enough time to vote for military and overseas voters.
Okay, great. And I appreciate you bringing that into this, wrapping that into the new CS. Really appreciate that. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Elliott, just to confirm, this means that still overseas voters can receive their ballot applications by email, but they cannot return them by email. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Sadler.
Sure.
Okay. Are there questions? Okay. All right. Also online, we have Alpheus Bullard with the Legislative Legal Division, Mark Sansusi with the Department of Defense. And that's it. Okay. So are there questions for the bill sponsor before we move to amendments? No? All right. Thank you, Cecile. Thank you. Also here we have Gail Fanumiai with the Division of Elections for questions. Okay. Did you have a question or did you want to present your amendments?
Yes. Madam Chair, I would like to move a conceptual amendment, which is not before us, but several of us have talked about it and I've agreed to move it. And that would be to retain the requirement of a witness or a ballot from somebody overseas, and I think that it's my belief, and others, I believe, agree with me, that it's hard to imagine a circumstance in which somebody can't find a witness who simply could say you sign it. If somebody's getting mail, there's somebody who delivers the mail. If there's a way to get it out, then you can take it to wherever you're going to mail it and have somebody witness it for you. And it's just, I appreciate the efforts to accommodate the needs of citizens who are in special circumstances, but at the same time, we want to do what we can to retain full confidence that the people who are voting are who they say they are. And I would like to retain the witness provision.
Okay. Are there comments or questions on that idea? to maintain the witness. Discussion? Yes, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the conceptual amendment. I actually consider this issue as well, because certainly the sanctity and integrity of the ballot is important. But I looked at the evidence available to us, and except for my own suspicions, not paranoia, but suspicions or concerns, I didn't see any evidence there was a problem with fraud. And I did hear some anecdotal evidence from advocates for the military voting rights that it is onerous, or at least puts a little bit more of a pebble in the shoe of the servicemen trying to vote. And in deciding which way it came down this, I thought I should orient towards making sure to give every opportunity for overseas voters to vote. The downside's not big. The upside's much bigger. So while I do respect and appreciate your position, I just want to make sure and fall down the side of making sure our service people can have their votes count easily.
Okay. Additional discussion? No. Okay. We have amendment, conceptual amendment. We call it conceptual amendment number one, to maintain the witness provisions. And just for clarification, Representative Gardner, that would include all three points A, B, and C under the previous draft. I don't believe it's in the new CS. Is it, Cecile? The witness provision was removed from the new CS, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, so if you can refer to the older version, that would be version E on page 3, 2, A, B, and C. And just for clarification, Representative Gardner, is that the a language that would be contained in your amendment? We're looking at the older version E,
okay.
Page 3, section 2, A, B, and C.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding. Well, I'm to the part I was looking at is page 2, beginning at line 6.
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, you're right.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah, I don't think I've got version
of current version X. Version X, page 2. Yes.
Page 2.
Line
6. The language that's in capitals and bracketed, I would like to retain that.
Could you read that for the record, please?
A certification that the affiant properly executed the markings of the ballot and gave the voter's identity blanks for the attesting official or witness, and not in brackets, a place for recording the date the envelope was sealed and witnessed. The envelope with the voter certificate must include a notice that a false statements made by the voter or by the attesting official or witness are punishable by law. Just retain the existing language without taking out the witness part.
Okay, and then for clarification, Cecile, in the older version on page 3, there's language that identifies the witness, I believe. It's the individual who is 18 years or older, an official authorized by federal law or law of the state in which the absentee ballot is cast to administer an oath, or a commissioned or non-commissioned officer. Are those the witness requirements, or am I misunderstanding this?
Chairman Yost, are you asking if that's the requirement for a witness?
Right.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Madam Chair, may I ask the sponsor about this? And I know you come by. You've done a great job of circling around, and I apologize for bringing this on you right now. But three of us were just talking about it beforehand, and I said, okay, I would do it, because I just can't imagine circumstances in which somebody has access to the ballot and the ability to return it and cannot find a single person to witness it. I mean, mm-hmm. It seems like somebody who really is alone someplace wouldn't be participating.
It would really be overwhelming.
Through the chair, would you like me to respond, Representative Gardner?
Yes, please do.
When, for military and overseas voters are in Iraq or Afghanistan, for example, there are a couple of things to ask. How do they know the witness is 18 if they are a foreign individual or a citizen for that matter? Is one thing to look at, and also a person can falsify a witness easier than they can falsify themselves. In order to vote absentee, you have to provide personal information to the division in order to vote. A witness does not have to do any of that. So it really is a policy call and a comfort level. I understand that. But those, if it's a potential impediment for someone to vote and there is no way to verify whether the witness is the witness, the other question, would we want to put someone in a position who didn't have a witness to falsify a witness?
If I, Madam Chair, if I do an absentee, a mail-in ballot, I believe I'm doing one for the municipal election, and I haven't looked at it, but I think that that has to be witnessed also because I'm mailing it in. I mean, doesn't that apply to all of us all the time? That I could just sign it and say, sign my daughter's name, send it in. I mean, I understand I'd be lying, but, I mean, the problem that the serviceman or woman has is something that all of us have to the same, with the same potential solution.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, if you're asking, does this witnessing requirement apply to all absentee voters, the answer is yes.
Okay. Representative Sadler and then Osterman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible to ask a question of Gail Finumiai, Director of Elections?
Sure would, yes. Okay. Yes.
Paul, she's coming up.
Sure. Mr. Representative.
In reading X version, I also go down to the bottom of page 2. And there's the same basic information starting on line 30, and the copy by it has been removed as far as the witness stuff is concerned. So it goes all the way to page 4 on line 9. Mm-hmm. Removed. So you might apply if you're going to make a change on the witness.
And so. Representative Gardner,
yes.
We had law look at this and draft an amendment.
Uh-huh.
And we just got it just now. So if you want to take a look at it, it as accomplishes.
Madam Chair, I'm going to withdraw my amendment. And if you'd like to move forward,
that's fine.
I'll leave that to you.
We had it done just in case.
It's better if it's drafted, and I'll just leave that to you.
Okay. All right. Well, do we have copies of the amendment? Okay. Can you circulate them?
Oh, yes, this is much more comprehensive.
Okay, so before you, let's call, well, you had conceptual amendments. Did you want to withdraw that, or do you want to?
Yes.
You did withdraw.
Yes,
okay.
Did.
So I'd like to move amendment number 1. Which accomplishes the intent of preserving the witness requirement. And go ahead. Amendment number 2. Okay, I'm sorry. amendment number 2, please. Yes, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Ms. Finumiai being here to ask a question. I'm going to throw you kind of a wide-open question. What is your experience with witnessing requirements? Is there any evidence of people trying to fraudulently witness ballots? Is it a problem that needs a solution, or is it a what's your views about witnessing? Just talk to us in general about witnessing.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the division doesn't have any evidence of people trying to fraudulently witness ballots. In fact, I was just trying to get information for how many ballots we actually reject because they forgot to have a witness, and I'm sorry I didn't have that for the committee, but I could bring. I know the number is very low, but the main problem that happens with our witnessing is that the witness will be the one to provide an identifier on the ballot envelope versus the voter. Even though it says voter's identifier, the witness sometimes puts, like, their driver's license down, number down, versus the voter putting their driver's license number down. But we've seen no evidence of fraud. I think it would be kind of difficult to prove fraud. It's a signature and a date, and that's what the witness has to do.
Okay. All right.
So the follow-up, so there's no certification, no notarization, no basically, it's a matter of trust anyway.
It's a matter of trust. It is. The statutes do say one person over the age of 18 or an individual who's authorized to administer an oath, such as a postmaster, a commissioned officer in the military, a judge, a magistrate. A notary can also sign. They do not have to provide a notarial seal. It's not required that our ballots require notarization.
Could you speak for a second about, I think there's four different ways that someone can verify their signature is their signature. For absentee ballot application, it's your last four digits of your social, your date of birth, your voter identification number, and is there a fourth identification?
I have to think here, sorry, through the chair. Voter number, date of birth, last, your full social, your last 4 years social. I think it just says last 4 years social.
Yeah,
and if there's one more, it's escaped me, and I will let you know. and those are unique to the voter. I mean, and so they have to provide one of those identifiers on their return by mail ballot in order for us to accept it. Even if they sign it and the witness witness it, without an identifier, we will not accept the ballot.
I have a question of Ms. Elliott. We've got our soldiers, airmen, Marines, everybody overseas trying to vote absentee. Are there any sanctions should a soldier or airman who's overseas who tried to falsify their ballot, what sanctions are available, or what penalty is there for falsifying a ballot for a soldier or airman overseas?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's a Class C felony for anyone to falsify information on a ballot.
Okay. That's the same penalty for a service member as for a civilian?
I would defer to Mark Sansucci for any further punishment through the federal government, but our state statute says that it's a Class C felony to falsify.
Mark Sansucci, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, would probably cover anyone trying to do that fraudulent activity you're talking about, and actually in the military, I would almost argue it would be more stringent under the UCMJ that they could actually be court-martialed for that kind of thing. So I cannot cite facts to you that where it's happened, but I know the Uniform Court of Military Justice would cover that particular instance.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Yes. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has Representative Thomas commented? I don't know if this issue has come up before and he's had a chance to say anything about it.
Representative Foster, through the chair, regarding the witness ring requirement?
Correct. Yeah, other than I know he's taken it out before and I don't know if he's changed his stance on that.
Representative Foster, through the chair, no.
Thank you.
For
clarification, Representative Thomas feels strongly about removing impediments to voting for military and overseas voters.
All right. So we have amendment number one before us. I don't believe I asked for objection. We had the discussion. I think I got out of process. Do you want to
object? I'll object for the sake of discussion.
Okay. What is the will of the body on amendment number one? Or rather, amendment number two. Sorry. Shall we call the roll? Yes. Okay, go ahead.
I'm willing to remove the objection.
Okay.
then I would object. Sort of,
you object? Like, okay. Representative Sadler objects. Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Sisna?
She's no longer online.
Representative Gardner?
I must say no.
Representative Osterman?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Dick?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
No.
Chair Munoz?
Yes. Was that 3-3?
Yes.
Okay, so what do we do in that case?
It
fails. Okay, got it. All right, so are there additional amendments?
Oh, yes. Madam Chair, I offer amendment number 3, it would be, and that is the one designated I.1. Is that what that is? Amendment number 3. Members will see that there's a second amendment on there in their packets, too. And both of these came out of the last election cycle. They both happened in District 6. I've talked with Representative Dick about it many times, and he understands, I believe, that this is not about him in particular. It's just that it illustrated to me a particular issue that concerned me. Currently, when the and correct me if I'm wrong in some of the details, because I'm but currently, after the filing deadline, the Division of Elections determines whether the applicants or the candidates are qualified to run. And the parties have 30 days to object to that determination. And occasionally, the Division of Elections will determine that somebody is not qualified to run and change their determination. But there's no requirement anywhere that when there's a change, that anybody be notified. So in this particular case, one candidate was deemed not qualified, and then sometime later, I'm thinking it was about 16 days later, that there was a change made, and that candidate was, I believe, quite properly, that determination was changed, and that candidate was deemed eligible or qualified to run, but nobody knew about it. And so when the change was made and the possibility of objecting now to the new finding came, the party was outside the time limit because they weren't notified. So what this amendment would do is just say simply if the Division of Elections changes their determination, they have to notify the to the candidate, him or herself, other candidates in the office, running for office, so that everybody knows that determination was changed. And then the person has it who might want to challenge that determination, the clock starts ticking from there. And to me, it just seems fair if there's a change after it's noted.
Okay. And did you move amendment number 3?
I offered it. I'll move it.
Okay. For discussion?
Yes.
Okay. Number 3. And is there objection?
I'll object to discussion.
Yes. Okay. And Representative Osterman?
Just so that I clearly understand, the notice would go to the candidate, and then it says other candidates for the office. So I'm assuming the means the same office that the original candidate was running.
Right. So
not all candidates.
Right. Just the candidates for that office. Yeah. So that the person who was deemed ineligible is now, or I guess the term you use is qualified.
Mm-hmm.
The person who was deemed not qualified now is notified, oh, you are qualified, and anybody else who's signed in that race is also told that that person is qualified.
Could you explain your interpretation of this amendment, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, my interpretation of this amendment is that if a challenge to a candidate is received, and has to be received within 10 days from the close of the filing deadline, and if then the division, the director, makes a determination to say that candidate is no longer a qualified candidate, that the director would then need to notify the candidate and all other candidates in that race of a change of eligibility qualification. And then a person could challenge my decision, the director's decision, within 30 days of making that decision.
Okay.
That's my interpretation of the amendment. Is that correct?
Okay. That's correct.
There, my only concern is that there's nothing in there saying when you receive a challenge to a change in candidate eligibility, how long does the division have to respond to that second challenge then? Because you could be getting closer and closer and closer to withdrawal deadline, the time to get ballots printed to the printer. So I'm not sure if that might want to be added in there, that within X number of days, a second review.
What would your suggestion be in terms of a time frame?
The statute allows 30 days for the initial eligibility challenge. I guess it just kind of depends when it's received. I would think, 10 days would probably be a pretty reasonable amount of time for the division to be able to make a decision on a secondary challenge then. On 10 days from the receipt of the challenge, the director of the division shall make a final determination.
Okay, does this apply after the filing date has closed?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And the candidate, I'm just trying to understand, the candidate's not eligible for whatever reason. And at that point, then the other candidates that were involved in the process leading up to that are notified. And then what happens?
Madam Chair, I guess I should say that a candidate can be challenged, their candidacy can be challenged at any time when they file their paperwork, but it has to be done no later than the 10th day following June 1st. So if you filed February 2nd, somebody can challenge your candidacy at any point in time during that process, no later than June 11th, 10 days following the candidacy filing deadline. At this point in time, there is no notification requirements in statute or state regulation to notify other involved parties of the division's decision to overturn a candidacy eligibility decision or to either they are qualified or they're not qualified. So this would put in there that the division would need to make that kind of notice available to other affected parties.
Okay, so if it's, I'm trying to understand, if it's within that 10-day following June 1st and say it's a party, the nominee of a party, let's say, then that nominee becomes ineligible. The other candidates that were part of that nomination process are informed? And what if there are no other candidates? And does the party get informed, or and how does that vacancy get filled?
Madam Chair, this amendment would say if the candidate is deemed ineligible and they're the only candidate for that particular party, there are no provisions for. It's my understanding there are no provisions for a candidate to be replaced. There are replacement provisions for if a candidate withdraws. I may be misspeaking here. Let me look here.
So that's troublesome.
Madam Chair,
if I might,
the circumstance that happened is Representative Dick was deemed ineligible. His opponent in the primary was deemed eligible, or qualified. I keep using qualified. But then they changed their decision, and it was, I don't remember if it was within the 10-day period that somebody else could challenge the determination. Then they said, okay, Challenger Dick is qualified, but it's too late for anybody to challenge that change in determination. And we're just saying they should tell somebody if they change their mind. And then the clock starts ticking in terms of how long you have to challenge it. It just seems, fairness to be able to do that. It applies in this race, but as I said, it's not about.
Madam Chair, it's just simply a notification issue here, I think, with this amendment, and then allowing the opposing party candidate to then further challenge the division's decision within 30 days. And I did misspeak, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. That was if they're nominated at the after the June 1 deadline. There are no provisions in statute for replacing a candidate. If something happens to them following the primary, then there are provisions for replacing a candidate.
Okay. Representative Dick.
Yeah, if I could clarify, too, and this is definitely a nonpartisan thing. It refers to the other candidates. And once it was clarified that I was eligible, then the other candidate within my party chose to withdraw. And so I was unopposed in the primary. So this would clarify things for everybody. There was some real muddy waters there for a while, and this would definitely clarify for everybody. There's no money harmed by this.
No, I think it's fine, but I'm just worried about the situation where a candidate is eligible up to June 1st and then is challenged within that 10-day period, and then, you know, because of the circumstances, there isn't another candidate, and there's not a provision to replace that candidate. Do you see?
Madam Chair, if I might, that's not addressed here. I mean, already, if you don't have a candidate to file by the deadline, or if you don't have a qualified candidate to file by the deadline, then you have no candidate. That's nothing to do with this.
No, but I'm saying if they were qualified as of the deadline, and then they become unqualified because of this
They're not becoming unqualified. It's just whether they're deemed qualified or not. And we do have candidates who completely are not qualified. I mean, in Anchorage, we had one candidate who filed routinely from a host of different districts and didn't necessarily live in any of them. I mean, that does happen. Then you don't have a candidate.
Madam Chair, the rules for challenging a candidate are not being changed by this amendment. I mean, the rules for challenging a candidate are still in place, and the drop-dead deadline for challenging a candidate's eligibility is 10 days following June 1st, the filing deadline day. So those rules are not changing. This is just simply providing notification to parties involved should a candidate's eligibility determination be changed as a result of a challenge that was filed timely by the 10th day following the filing deadline.
No, I understand that, but it points out a problem in the process that if somebody's challenged after June 1st, after the deadline, and then is found to be unqualified, then that leaves that, you know, without it, that nominee without a candidate, right? It seems to me that there should be provisions to address that in statute. But Representative Sadler.
So to clarify, this is just to inform somebody whether they're going to, if they're challenged, if they stay dead or they come back to life, in essence.
Through the chair, basically, Representative Sadler, yes. I mean, it's to let folks know.
Who's in the race?
Yeah. A candidate's eligibility determination has been reversed, and here's the final say, and then according to this amendment, someone could challenge that decision still within 30 days, which maybe that might be the time frame for which you want to shorten and not make it a full 30 days. Maybe make it within 15 and then say I have to respond within 15, and then everything is resolved within 30 days. That's just a friendly suggestion.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to amend my amendment conceptually, and I'll go with the director's suggestion that on line 10, the challenge must be made in writing within 15 days after the mailing of the notice, which effectively gives them 5 days to actually receive it and the same 10 days to challenge. And also add a section, this is conceptual, that the division shall make a final decision within 15 days from receipt of the challenge.
Okay. Is there a discussion on the... Yes.
Is that within 15 days of receipt of the challenge or the date of the challenge? Or does the challenge not exist until it's received and logged in?
Madam Chair, I think it should be the date of the challenge because that's a firm date. If I mail a challenge or I hand deliver it, I know what date it went in. And whereas if it's from the date, I could say I mailed it, but who knows when the Division of Election gets it, so we don't really know when the clock starts ticking on the 15 days. Does that make sense?
I mean, it's through the chair, Representative Gardner. That's totally the will of the committee, whatever you decide.
Okay. Is there discussion on the change? Yes, Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Madam. Gail, did I hear you say that on the original complaint you have 10 days to make a determination?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, the original complaint, let me look here, has to be filed within 10 days of the filing deadline. And
your response.
My response I mean, we try to get them done as soon as possible. Let me look here. It says, of course, I just have my fingers in there.
We've got to make it consistent with what we're doing.
I'll find it just one moment.
If I might respond to the question while the director's looking, I think the idea is that if I'm a candidate, I filed for office, and I know it's on me to check within 10 days to see who's in the race, who's not within 10 days. But if there's a change afterwards, I'm not necessarily checking every day because you think it's finalized, and that was the problem here.
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, the regulations outline the procedure for, you know, looking into the eligibility of a candidate based on candidate complaints, and there is no deadline in regulation as to how long it takes for us to respond. But it's, you know, time is of the essence, and we obviously need to get ballots printed and whatnot, so we turn those things around pretty quickly.
Okay. Are there additional questions on Amendment Number 3? Okay. There was objection to the amendment. Representative Dick, I believe, objected. Did you want to remove your objection?
I remove my objection.
Okay. And is there further objection on Amendment Number 3? Okay. Hearing none, it is ordered. Amendment Number 3 passes. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move Amendment Number 4. And I might say I'm really glad the director is here today to answer these questions. But basically, my understanding is that a voter who registers to vote can choose to keep their address secret and not release their address. They can use a mailing address, or they can ask that the address not be released. Is
that through the chair, Representative Gardner, a voter can request that the resident's address be kept confidential, meaning it's not released to the general public when people buy voter lists. They can only do that if they have a mailing address that differs from their residence address.
Thank you. And it turns out that a candidate can do the same thing and doesn't have to release their residence address. We have to, when we become candidates, we do financial disclosures, and we talk about who we owe money to and what we own and where our income comes from, and anybody who lives with us, the same kind of information. And it just seems to me that when we're talking about whether or not a candidate is qualified to run for office, part of that is the people in the district knowing where that person lives. And it turns out that that doesn't have to be public information. What Amendment Number 4 does is simply say that the declaration of candidacy, which does provide a residence address, is a public record. And so the residence of every candidate is a public record.
Okay. Is there objection to the amendment?
Objection for discussion.
Yes. Noted. Representative Osterman.
Thank you. Gail, can you... Do you know the history behind keeping that residence address private?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, I wasn't at the division at the time, but I was told it was a bill that was passed by Senators Guess and Terrio, and I believe it was implemented as to protect victims of domestic violence, police officers, judicial officers who did not want their residence address to be released to the public. May I add, this is not related to the history of the bill, but the division does have access to everybody's residence address, and so we are able to validate the eligibility of a candidate. I just wanted to make that clear to the committee that that what Representative Gardner is saying here is that you as a candidate couldn't get your opponents, perhaps, residence address information if they had chosen to keep their residence address confidential.
Madam Chair, if I might, more importantly, it's not the candidate knowing where the other candidates live. It's the voters being able to ascertain for themselves if that person really does live where they say they live. And we've had a lot of contested residencies over the years. I remember one candidate who said he was living with his parents, and then they were going to lose their senior property tax exemption, and he gave another address that turned out it wasn't in the district, and he gave another address. I mean, I think it's fair for voters to be able to determine where somebody who wants to represent them lives, even if the Division of Elections has done so. I mean, somebody may give an address, and as far as the Division of Elections knows, that's true, but I might live right next door and know that's not true. I'm a voter.
Well, I can say as a candidate at the local level that when my address was public, that, you know, I started to receive visits from somebody that was very threatening to me personally. That was a local race that I ran in, and so I can definitely see the benefit for not making that public. But anyway, go ahead, Representative Osterman.
Gail, how often is a request made to keep a public official candidate address secure?
Through the chair, my recollection is last year there was one candidate whose residence address was confidential. We had a request for the declaration of candidacy and were not allowed by state law to release the residence address. The candidate would not, we can ask for permission from the voter to release it. The candidate would not let us release it, said that information would appear at the time the official voter's pamphlet was printed, and we were not allowed to release that candidate's information at that time.
Just to clarify that statement, that when the pamphlet went out, that resident address was made public?
Through the chair, Representative Washburn, yes, because the candidate then chose at that time to provide that information to the division for publication in the official election pamphlet.
Had the candidate decided to keep it confidential, then the information would have been published, but it still not had an address on it.
Through the chair, Representative Washburn, that's correct, because the information a candidate chooses to disclose in the pamphlet is entirely up to that candidate.
There's objection to the amendment. Is there further discussion? No? Let's see.
I'll remove my objection because I think this is just good.
Do you think? Okay. Is there continued objection? If not, I object.
I'm glad you did. I've got some concerns just that certainly the title of the bill is broad enough to allow this, but I think this gets into an area that the sponsor of the original legislation I don't think wanted to get into. It sounds like this is a measure to allow for overseas and absentee ballots. Certainly, technically, there's no reason why this kind of thing shouldn't happen, but I think it kind of muddies the waters a bit. Certainly might be appropriate topic for another bill, though.
Okay. Objection is noted.
Madam Chair, if I might respond to that. I attempted to talk to the sponsor of the bill, spoke with the staff, and could not get an endorsement, but also no objection, and she can speak to that, too. So he has known about this for over a month.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir.
I have a question. Maybe I'm really behind the curve in understanding here, but if somebody is falsely claiming a residency, couldn't we challenge that person, and wouldn't she be responsible for validating whether that person actually lived there? And I was certainly vetted in that regard. So that the information, so that we were sure that person lives in that place, because the Division of Elections has done that job for us, but yet the actual residence is the candidate still safe. Help me on that.
Madam, why don't we have a rep? I'm sorry.
Sorry,
Representative Kumanai.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, if somebody challenges the residence address of a candidate, saying there is no such house number on such and such a street, and the division does look into that, obviously we would make appropriate decisions regarding that candidate's eligibility, because an address does not exist. So, yes, we would look into situations like that.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, if I, for example, decided I didn't want to live in the house I live in now and rented it with utilities included, I could show the Division of Elections my property deed, my property taxes, all my utility bills while I'm living in a condo downtown. And there's no way that the Division of Elections could know that there might be rumors. The only people who could know that I'm not really living there are my neighbors, who know that they haven't seen me in a year and there's somebody else moving in and out that's not my family members. And that's why it's important for the residents in my district to be able to ascertain for themselves, because we do have disputed places. And I know many times I've heard where people say, well, so-and-so doesn't really live in his district, mm-hmm. and so-and-so doesn't either, you know. And only the voters in the district can know that. And we give up so much of our privacy when we run for office. You can look at my financial statements and know, you know, all of my assets, my husband's employment, when my kids are living with me, you know who they work for, all kinds of things. And it seems to me to simply withhold the one piece of information that allows the voters to know that I really do live in the district, for the voters to ascertain, because people can misrepresent the facts, and we know that they have and do.
Representative Osterman.
One of the thought is that when I, as an elected official, I file a financial statement with the state, and in my original declaration of candidacy, I want my address kept secret. So when I am an elected official and file my financial statement, is my address still confidential?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, your residence address being confidential is only at the division level. I can't address how APOC handles that.
If I remember correctly, it does require me to put it on.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What would happen in that situation if, say, I contested somebody else's eligibility or their residency, and then so you went to them and said, please provide proof, for example, a utility bill. They gave that to you. I came back and said, well, you know, I know that they've got a renter in there, and what would you do in that situation to follow up? What would be the next step?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, the way the statute reads that if a preponderance of evidence supports the eligibility of candidate, then the director would issue a final determination of the candidate's eligibility. Upholding the candidate's eligibility. In your case, and this I'm hypothetically speaking because I haven't personally been addressed with the situation, if we had information from people saying that the house is being rented to to someone else, we then perhaps would ask the candidate to respond to that. And based on the information they provided, I mean, the utility bills could still be in the candidate's name. However, if they're not physically living in the house, we would request information from the candidate and then consult, obviously, with the Department of Law, add all the evidence we have, and make a decision if the preponderance of evidence supports one way or the other.
So there.
Go ahead.
So just to, emphasize, there would be collaboration, for example, with the Department of Law, and okay.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, yes, we would take the evidence we have, work with the Department of Law, and make that determination.
Thank you.
I have a question. You said that Senator Guess and Senator Terrio worked on the original legislation, and usually when a bill's brought forward, it's to deal with a specific situation that's happened in the communities. Are you aware of what the history was leading up to that and what the circumstances were that
Madam Chair, I do not have personal history with that, but what I have been told was that it was to address issues of people, victims of domestic violence, and people who have been threatened perhaps by stalkers, and police officers wishing to keep their residence address confidential for various reasons. Mm-hmm. I was not personally involved with that legislation when it went through the legislature.
Okay. All right. Is there, does the objection remain? Are there additional questions?
You have the objection.
I have the objection, yes, and I want to maintain my objection. Did you have another question?
Another comment.
Yeah.
I think the public has a right to know, and I think that by withholding one piece of information based upon the fact that we all live in 40 districts across the state, that those addresses should be verifiable by the public, not just state officials themselves. So I support that.
Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Osterman.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Dick.
Yes.
Chairman Yost.
No.
Okay, are there additional amendments? Okay, so we have the bill, the CS before us, version X. Can I have a motion on the... we have the bill before us. Can I have a motion to move it from committee, please?
I have a question first.
You have it. Okay, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. And we discussed this earlier, and I just need a little clarification, if you would. We're talking about moving up the time of the primary. Is that correct? What portion of version X, where's that described in here? Here was my thought. I've only been in one election, and I won the primary because I was unopposed. as I was thinking through on this, I mean, okay, I moved the primary, but then it dawned on me, here in Alaska, we have so many, as we try to reach the constituents, there's so many fairs. You know, there's the Palmer Fair, there's the Deltana Fair, there's the Kenny Lake Fair, there's the Antioch Fair, there's all the fairs where people would actually, where you have a chance to contact the constituents. And it was my thought that it was hard enough to run as a totally unknown challenger, but without those fairs, this is going to bump the primary up before any of those fairs. So this, by moving the primary up that much earlier, is going to be far more heavily in favor of the incumbent. And so I just wonder if we could have a little discussion on that before we make them. I'd like to hear from somebody that's actually ran 2, 3, 4 times and how this really would impact the primary.
I don't live in a district that big that's got that many fairs.
Wouldn't impact me at all.
No.
Yeah, it wouldn't impact me at all either. I've got a fairly diverse district compared to somebody like President Gardner, but I've got all of the Lake and Penn area and all the villages around 14 or 15 communities. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't affect, actually, in my view, it probably helps, given me, assuming that I'm going to get through the primary, it gives me better timing to actually work the general election.
Could you, Representative Dick, in the bill, draw us to that date?
I asked that
point where we can,
Madam Chair,
focus in on the fair schedule, and you can kind of give us some input on the dates that are affected. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, that's Section 14 of the bill.
Section 14. Primary election is held on the second Tuesday.
Excuse me, Madam.
Go ahead.
Okay. I just raised it as a question, and I'm probably the least experienced person here to comment on it. But I was just thinking of the timing of things. It would actually... it just seems to me that it really heavily favors the incumbent. That was my thought. It would actually be better for me now that I'm the incumbent, because I only had a 2-week window between the time of the primary and the beginning of hunting season. I mean, I went to Northway and shook hands with all three people who weren't moose hunting. So September was really a waste for me. So this really would help when it comes to the rural districts for somebody actually to get out and meet people between the time of the primary and then the time of when fall activities start. Okay. So I just want to hear other people's viewpoints with that in mind.
So when are the the fairs? What are the dates?
Rep. Munoz, if you're asking the question of the fairs, that would be Representative Dick.
They vary. They vary. And
tend to be at the end of August? Is that...
from the 15th to the end of August, and Well, they try not to conflict with each other, and it moves around every year. I mean, they try not to have the Candlelight Fair the same weekend as the Deltana Fair. So, and then the Antioch, they do move around with each other, and a lot of them have to do with farming, have to do with crops and whatnot. So, the date of the primary is which? Was that the?
The second Tuesday.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, under the proposed law, the 2012 primary would be August 14th. And if the date of the primary was not changed, it is August 28th.
So, Director, does that then change everything else in the bill? Aren't there time frames that need to be met that affect the whole cycle?
Representative Munoz, the dates that were chosen in the bill are reflective of having the primary election the second Tuesday in August. So the division can definitely say to the federal government and Department of Justice that we are able to comply with getting ballots mailed to our military and overseas voters 45 days before the election. And post-primary, moving the primary up 2 weeks helps with the post-primary issues that happen. Certification, recounts, appeals, election contests, which even moving the primary election up 2 weeks, we're really bumping up very, very close to that 45 days before the general election.
Okay, so to go back to the fourth Tuesday really makes it affects the intent of this bill.
Yes.
Yes, okay. All right, is there further discussion on the idea? Representative Dick, what would you like to do?
I'm trying to think. There's really plus and minus on both sides. It seems like my district, which might not even exist in 2 years, is the only one severely impacted by this. And I do see some very positive things in moving the date up, like when the primary in for the senator race on the Republican side really did, that carried on so long after the primary. It really did get confusing. So, weighing it out, I think I like it the way it is.
Okay. All right. Further discussion on the CS? Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you again. Not so much discussion as I do appreciate the efforts to expand the voting franchise, and thanks to the sponsor's representative for bringing this forward. I do understand that there's a problem that there's many, many soldiers on extended deployment. We want to make sure they have the opportunity to vote. We have more people living overseas who want to maintain their Alaska residency. They're proud of being Alaskans. That's good. I want to encourage that. And I think given the occasionally abysmal turnouts and voting percentages, we should do all we can to encourage and support voting. As I've said on the record, I've got some concerns about some small aspects of the bill, but overall, I want to err on the side of helping people vote rather than hindering their voting. So I'm going to support this. And I agree with Representative Dick on the issue of the moving the date back 15 days. That does eat into summer, hunting season, recreational season. So there might be some diminution of voting turnout, but it does give you some breathing room and space at the other end. And we've had some experience in all the things that can compact the process at the other end. So in the interests of uniforming voting procedures across the country, giving more time to do all of the happy things you do at the Division of Elections, I think on balance it's a good bill. So I'm going to support it.
Okay. All right. So do we have a motion to move the bill from committee? I don't think so. Was there fiscal notes?
Madam Chair, there's a zero fiscal note, indeterminate fiscal note. On the bill.
Representative Foster.
Madam Chair, I would move CS for House Bill 178, version 27-LS0304/X-ray, and with amended.
Okay. All right. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the bill moves from committee. Thank you very much. And if you'll just, yeah. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? Okay, hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you.